Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. I need a little more light tonight because I, my good black pen the other way. Okay, so here we go. last night, we left off our discussion about you can release your habit mind of beginningless projection with a ringing statement by our hermit of Mount Song. When you ask about the precepts, you are already observing the precepts because there are no precepts apart from seeking out the precepts. This brings us to address our topic for tonight. The Lankavatara and the Heart Sutra insist, that when we listen first, which is the most direct way of releasing habit mind, and really where the Heart Sutra starts, right? Avalokiteshvara, practicing deep, Prajnaparamita, which is listen first without listen without first interrupting, fundamentally. So when we do that and we discover that we don't have to believe every insistent thought or emotion that comes tramping into our otherwise wild and solitary mountain hideout, we are truly available to be useful. And we don't have to go looking for a job, it will come find us. In other words, we are standing on the bare ground, ready to respond. Really? Really? When we release habit mind, mm-hmm. when we don't get bullied by our projections, then we are ready, like that servant with bowed head, to respond. I thought, well, you know, I don't want to just sort of say, well, this is so, right? We need to check it out, mm-hmm. right? Does it check out? So, important also to remember the first bits of the teaching, that you got the ancestors, right? You're not just standing there on your own without anybody got your back. You are very solitary, but and they've got your back. So, and, you know, our mountain hermit tells us that we just have to call on them, mm-hmm. right? And that's really what he's saying when he says, when you go looking for the precepts, when you ask for the precepts, that's just calling the ancestors, mm-hmm. right? So when you call them, and then second, you've got your vows, yeah? That part really reminded me of a story that I'm sure you're sick of hearing me say, but sorry, because it comes up so strongly for me in this regard, this part that says, you've got your vows. Mm-hmm. So in two ways, actually, but the first one's the Journey from Zanskar, that wonderful film about the two young geishas who just finished their doctoral work, basically, in Ladakh, I guess. And, you know, at the graduation, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, "And so now what are you going to do for your people?" And they're like, So they decide that they're going to go up into the wilds, into the high Tibet, tiny villages that don't even have enough food, you know, for people, let alone any schooling. And of course the Chinese aren't helping. So there's a risk of the religious tradition and the language and all of the culture to be lost. So they decide they're going to go up there and bring children down to school over this extremely dangerous high mountain pass. And so this wonderful film is about that journey. But the part that I want to point to, having to do with vows, is this wonderful, awful night when they've had one delay after another. You know, the horses didn't get delivered, the food didn't get delivered, you know, the weather closed in on them. I mean, everything's looking pretty bad. And they are sheltering in this sort of a cave, dugout cave structure of some sort, in the snowstorm, because they just can't go on until at least get through that night. And this young geisha, and this is being filmed, yeah? Mm-hmm. So this young geisha is down in the hole where they're sleeping in the middle of the night. He's freezing cold. You know, he's got a sleeping bag, but it's awful cold, right? And they're not sure who's going to die that night. You know, they're not sure that any of them are going to survive the night. And so he's sort of talking into his little recorder very quietly. And he's going on about, well, we don't know, you know, we don't know if we'll get through the night, but, you know, we might or we might not, you know. I'm not a bodhisattva. I just took bodhisattva vows. And you can hear him thinking, and why exactly did I do that? But here I am, yeah? So, that. You got your vows. And then the second point about that is, even if you didn't, you do. Because you can't give up. You've tried, you know, you've tried to say, I'm throwing in the towel, I don't care about this shit anymore. And what happens, you know, in a little while, there you are. Because you're the desire to know how to be helpful just keeps popping its head up like one of those little children's toys where you whack it down with a hammer, you know. We're made of it. And over time, like it or not, we do develop a capacity for tolerating the way it actually is, for tolerating not actually having a real solid self we thought we had, tolerating that we're not ever actually going to get our life under control, you know, tolerating that most of the time we don't know what to do, tolerating that things don't just turn out some way or another and stay that way. You know, they go on, yeah? So tolerating the way it is. And, you know, as we live on, one delusion after another falls. And eventually, there are those moments where the tree withers and the leaves fall, right? I mean, they happen all along, but you notice them more as you get older. And that's a good thing, right? That's called maturity, when you recognize the truth of that koan, right? Mm-hmm. What is happening? What is really happening when the tree withers and the leaves fall? It's golden wind. Mm-hmm. Body exposed in golden wind. So I think I'm going a little fast. Are you following where I'm going with this? Mm-hmm. Maybe? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. Okay. So you got your vows. That's the step I'm on, right? Mm-hmm. And so you've got them because you make them, and you've got them even if you don't make them. And because life is giving them to you, right? You've got the unquenchable desire that keeps rising up to learn how to be helpful. Mm-hmm. And you get more able to tolerate the way things actually are. So, golden wind reveals itself in whom we can truly take refuge. And we discover one more essential fact. Responsiveness is not just you coming forth as you, body and mind, right? We think of responsiveness as, okay, I'm going to come, dwelling nowhere, come forth as this mind, right? Well, okay, but it turns out that the vastness is not a vacuum. It's so easy to fall into that trap of thinking that the vastness just means this great big vacuum outside of you. Even though, that delusion is fairly persistent. It keeps on popping up. But actually, and not a place and not a thing. So it's just the way things are, right? The vastness fundamentally is a name for something about how it is, how things are, how it happens, how it all goes. And responsiveness responds to, right? By definition. Mm-hmm. And so it's messy as all get out. So once again, we have a poem or three, and then a koan. So these poems are about this. The first one. No. The first one. Sorry, it is this one. I once thought that life's what's left over after I extricate myself from the mess. I was writing a poem about paying attention and microwaved a hot dog so hot it burned a beet red hole in the roof of my mouth. Lucretia Borgia got shit on her fingers by not paying attention. Chanting a sutra, the monk stepped fatally on the viper's tail. Every gun is loaded and cocked. So I love that poem for its willingness to just disabuse us of the notion that if we're mindful, everything will be just fine. I have personal experience with this.
Is that Tony?
No, this is Jim Harrison. But can you see how that's part of this? Is, responsiveness is just not this neat, tidy thing, mm-hmm. right? It's messy. So here's the next one. Who remembers Wang Che? Quote, the real human like multiplied sunlight. Quote.
Read that again, please.
Who remembers Wang Che? The real human like multiplied sunlight. No one, of course. But his words are a lamp for any fool's feet. He can't stop you from drowning, but he can keep you out of the boat. Out of the boat. He can't stop you from drowning, but he can keep you out of the boat. The water is meant for careful wading, but imagining my ears are gills, I still dive there at night. Okay, I'll do this one more time because it takes a minute to figure out what's the out of the boat part about. Yeah, keeps you from just climbing out and being safe. Yeah, this whoever this is, I don't know Wang Che. Nobody does, apparently. must be somebody. Who remembers Wang Che? The real human-like multiplied sunlight. That's a pretty cool epithet for somebody to have. Who remembers Wang Che, the real human-like multiplied sunlight? No one, of course. But his words are a lamp for any fool's feet. He can't stop you from drowning, but he can keep you out of the boat. This water's meant for careful wading, but imagining my ears are gills, I still dive there at night. This is the Bodhisattva vow. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to just stay safe. Yeah? Though it may look like I could just wade in this water, but no, watch out for that Bodhisattva vow. You'll be diving at night too, right? And then this third one follows the other one in my book. This morning I felt strong and jaunty in my mail order Israeli commando trousers. Up at Hard Luck Ranch, I spoke to the ravens in baritone, fed the cats with manly gestures. Acacia thorns can't penetrate these mighty pants. Then, out by the corral, the infant pup began to weep, abandoned. In an instant, I became another of Earth's billion sad mothers. You want to hear that one again?
Please.
Yeah.
That is really poignant in today's going on.
This morning I felt strong and jaunty in my mail order Israeli commando trousers. Up at Hard Luck Ranch, I spoke to the ravens in baritone, fed the cats with manly gestures. Acacia thorns can't penetrate these mighty pants. Then, out by the corral, the infant pup began to weep, abandoned. In an instant, I became another of Earth's billion sad mothers. So it's messy, it's dangerous, and we must. Yeah. We develop a capacity for tolerating the way it is. We stay in the game, heart broken, open. So here's the con. For once, it's one I haven't brought in before. Brand new, fresh con. So this one, let me make sure I've connected the dots here. Are you okay so far with a sense of where we're going?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Okay.
I'm the class dummy, not keeping up.
Okay. So I'm bringing in this con because to me, it connects completely with the mess. It's a mess. It's dangerous, and we must. Okay. And it goes a little beyond the somberness of it, I think. We must, I guess this one adds, and we get to. Maybe that's a good thing to bring in. Yeah, not only we must, but we get to. Okay, Book of Serenity, case 65. Shoshan's new wife. I am loving this koan because none of the pundits agree about it. So you definitely get to have your own take on this koan, which is fun, right? A student asks Shoshan, "What is Buddha?" Okay. Shoshan said, "The new wife rides a donkey. Her mother-in-law leads it by the bridle." That's the koan. So much shorter story than last night. And nonetheless, Shoshan's new wife. A student asks Shoshan, "What is Buddha?" Shoshan said, "The new wife rides a donkey. Her mother-in-law leads it by the bridle." So I have to read you just for the fun of it. The little, you know, in these there's a little preamble, usually a little preface that comes before the koan, and this one is will give you a hint of something. It goes, tut, tut, pshaw, pshaw, stripping, removing, puff, puff, whoosh, whoosh, vague, confusing, impossible to chew, hard to approach. Tell me, what story is this? So in case that sort of reflects the way you're feeling at the moment. Okay, so why does this story touch me so much? How is this story about how we actually embody this? What is a Buddha? Meaning, what am I when I'm a Buddha? Right?
Who am I when?
What am I when I'm a Buddha? Why else would you ask what is Buddha? Right? Mm-hmm. What is it to be, what is Buddha action like? So, or what is being a Buddha like might be a way to rephrase the question. Yeah. What am I like when I be Buddha? Okay. The new wife writes it. So usually, you know, in Chinese culture, you would expect the reverse, wouldn't you? The new bride is coming into her mother's household, her mother-in-law's household. She will essentially be her mother-in-law's servant for most of her adult life, or at least a good chunk of it. So normally it would be the new wife leading the donkey while her mother-in-law rides, yeah? The folk saying actually says, it comes from a folk saying, which actually says, it's backwards. It's backwards, the new wife rides a donkey. Her mother-in-law leads it by the bridle. Okay. So how is our practice of coming, standing on the bare ground with our bare feet and meeting what comes to meet us, how is that like this? Yeah? If that's sort of the fundamental Buddha action move, how is that like this? So the one thing that's sort of striking about it to begin with, I think, is the plainness of it. You know, here they are, you know, it's stated in a very matter-of-fact way, right? Here they are. The bride's riding on a donkey, the mother-in-law's holding the bridle. So ordinary, but unusual. And you don't sort of hear any overlay of distress, like, you know, what's wrong with this picture? It's just, there it is, yeah? Just going along. And clearly, that mother-in-law, whom you think would be embarrassed in her village to be seen pulling her daughter-in-law on a donkey, as far as we can tell, she's completely unconcerned. So on one level, we can say she's responding to circumstances. And I love how the story doesn't tell us any, like, why, right? So that's like in Linji, what we read, eons ago on the first day, the first full day, that says, just respond to circumstances and use up your old karma, right? You get the feeling that this is just respond to circumstances. If we don't feel like we have to have an opinion, this is backwards, right? So again, once we don't have an opinion of what it's going to look like to others when we do this, how much freer are we to respond? There's that. Yeah. Second thing, for me, what I notice is the bride, she's treasure actually for the family, right? She is going to be really essential to the survival and thriving of this family. Not only is she going to do a lot of work, but maybe have babies, and there will be that the family continues. And she is freshly emerged out of the vastness in some sense, right? She here she comes, a gift, you know, to the family. And she's young. She's probably scared. She probably doesn't want to be there because that was not a, you know, those were not love matches. They were practical. And from at least what I've read, which is not a whole lot, but some, you know, she could expect not to ever see her family again. Or at least once a year. I think they tried to make an arrangement that once a year you were allowed to go and see your family. Boy, that year would have felt like a long time to a young woman in that situation. So she's untried and has a lot to learn and is going to have some tough times. Yeah. And So I thought, what about us and our awakening? You know, we get those first big flashes of light, right? And then we think this ought to do the trick, right? And fairly soon we get disabused of that notion. And so in a way, there's a sense of here we come, being recognized as a treasure, or the insight. You know, we could see her as the insight that we get too, couldn't we? You know, here comes our fresh insight out of the vastness. And and we're holding the bridle. Yeah, we've got some work to do, haven't we? Before this becomes useful. And then I had a flash to the Oxfording pictures, right? These two have a relationship to make. Mm-hmm. We and our insight have a relationship to make. And so part of standing barefoot on the bare ground is also recognizing what we draw on, yeah? That we have a relationship to make, that we're just beginning. It's always the first day, yeah? In that spot. So that was another thing that I just kind of noticed about it. Life will form her, yeah? And so here's this other funny thing. One of the Shoshan was asked in another encounter, was asked, what is the Buddha's unspoken saying? What's the Buddha's unspoken saying?
Saying.
What's the Buddha teaching without saying anything? Yeah? The teaching of the Buddha that's without any words. Yeah. And Shoshan said, activity expresses the ancient road, not falling into a somber, passive state. Mm-hmm. So this koan seems to me also to be saying that our activity, and it's like your expression of the actual body is the harbor and the weir, mm-hmm. right? Your expression of it, not your ideas about it. And so again, it finds us in that place where recognizing that we have what we need, you know, like the woman at the Pilgrim's Inn. This isn't so hard, you know, this isn't so hard. And she carries it with her in her activity. Responding, responding, responding. Yeah? So there are two commentary verses in the Blue Cleary, in Cleary's Book of Serenity. One of them says, stop saying these words are a reverse. The new bride is drunk. And rides on the donkey. People laugh and laugh at the mother-in-law leading. Remind you at all of those three poems that I read at the beginning? Yeah. And so this also, you know, as I've mentioned, I've been reading some teachings by Trungpa. So I'm going to backtrack a little bit. So with regards to the new bride is drunk, right, and everybody's laughing at the mother-in-law, would somebody open a window somewhere? Thank you. Thanks. Ah. So the drunken new bride who's riding when she should be pulling you on your donkey is the treasure, right? Is in fact the treasure. That your life that won't behave, your life that has no clue what it's doing, your life that acts like a privileged, you know, princess drunk and expecting to be taken care of. That life, right? That when you've got, you know, what if that's the treasure? Yeah? What if that's your Buddha nature? And so the and how many koans have we had where it's ridiculous and everybody's going to be laughing, right? Everybody's going to be making fun of you. The family shame, remember, there's language like that a lot. So Trungpa, when he's talking about this, some of the tantric yanas, says that, like, after the marriage, as practice matures, the magical quality begins to enter your system so that you actually become a bodhisattva. I'll read that again, that after the marriage, he's really talking about vows, too. He's talking about that deepening of commitment. After you are so fully committed, you're there ain't no getting back, going back. The magical quality begins to enter your system so that you actually become a bodhisattva. So sort of like that poor Geshe in the snow saying, wait, you know, I'm not a bodhisattva, I just took bodhisattva vows, which is, of course, ironically, the moment when he's a bodhisattva. Yeah? And we can see that. He doesn't, fortunately, he doesn't know it. So there are these three mandalas that come in here, and one of them is the mandala of isness, which Trungpa describes as the feminine principle. Mind unborn and unlimited. Okay, so the sort of fresh, brand new, still in the wedding dress quality. And the mandala of, and also cervix, which I talked about in other times. And also the mandala of self-existence. So isness really, really representing sort of vastness here, yeah? And self-existence, the masculine principle, being sort of more represented by everything that happens, the unceasing play of phenomena. So like form and emptiness, right? Or emptiness and form in another language. But and then the third mandala being the sun of great joy. That, so the union, right? Indivisible. So he goes on after this, and I realize this is awfully abstract, but if we picture a mandala as actually a sort of like a 3D printer, you know, a representation of, or an archetype of our actual being, and that these three are us, then when we are in action in our daily life, we're going to be at a place where, if we're embodying this, which we are, and in particular, having made these vows, we are, whatever vows we've made, conscious or unconscious, then everything that happens is that child. Everything that happens is part of this mandala. Yeah? And that means our delusions are the very thing, baby. Are the very grist for that mill. They're the treasure. And so, do you see how this goes back to
wait. Can you go back just a little?
Okay.
I don't get how it's the treasure.
Okay. I'm feeling like maybe it's not very helpful for me to bring in the mandala stuff. It may just feel too far removed from what we're doing. So I may not want to dwell on it. I may want to just say that at the point where we are in the, what we've been talking about, the important thing about this story of the bride is just to note that that her very drunkenness and our unruliness of what comes to meet us brand new is the treasure. Okay. And a lot of times it's that means what comes to meet us is our own delusions, our own projections, right? Mm-hmm. And that is the treasure. It's kind of where I wanted to go with that. And I could tell I wasn't presenting that in a way that will make sense yet, so I want to go beyond it. So that's this commentator saying, stop saying these words are reversed. The new bride is drunk and rides on the donkey. People are laughing at the mother-in-law leading. So it's that how ridiculous, just like in the poems, you know, how ridiculous, I'm going diving thinking I have gills, right? It's that kind of ridiculous. It's exactly the thing that we must do. And then the other verse says, the new bride rides the donkey, her mother leads it. Their appearance and style are indeed are elegant and natural. They are elegant and natural. So it's completely the flip side, right? The new bride rides, her mother-in-law leads it. Their appearance and style are elegant and natural. How laughable, the neighbor girls imitating a frown. So do you see how that's just the opposite? It's like, why not? Right? Why not? Okay. So I have one more poem, which may make more sense than what I just brought in. But I hope that image will actually have archetypal power. That's the way it felt to me, was the coming to the place where at every other moment I can say, this is ridiculous and how wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even when it's awful, it's like, you know, this is ridiculous and I don't get it. Oh, this is interesting. Or like Bernie Glassman, you know, going to Auschwitz or going to the needle park outside of what city in Germany, saying, I noticed I didn't understand, so I had to go there. This is like that, right? I noticed I didn't understand, so I had to go there. So here's that last poem. So I don't know, does that help with the story? to me, that's a bridge that I only just noticed, but I think it maybe is helpful. Okay, the poem. Okay, the poem is called No Thank You. Wisdom isn't scarce, it never was. The average bookshelf of a psych major named James at Cumberland Community College will yield all the wisdom that was ever necessary to end war, teach kindness, face death, sprout honesties like flowers, fashion codes of understanding for a working world. We have everything we need. Don't know what the hell it is, don't want it, won't remind each other, refuse to listen. What makes it worse are the constant bulletins from all those liars who keep saying, we are looking for solutions, getting close to, poised to make the breakthrough, any day now. Not true. We already have chosen the strange garments of confusion that we will die in. We love the thrill of enemies. We burn through beauty like it was wrapping paper. We breathe the smoke of our distraction like it was oxygen. So this morning, I will just walk into the woods off Marsden Lane, seize a clump of dirt and pine straw in my fist, and kneel in a manner no different from any peasant in a jerkin in the 14th century asking for salvation, saying, preserve me, God, at least from the pretense that I am searching. I am lost by choice, and all the evidence suggests that I relish it.
And that was which author?
That one was Tony Hoagland. Yes. So that's the Bodhisattva vow, isn't it? Mm-hmm. To continue to be born into this very world, lost by choice and relishing it. So that's it.